From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, women's health. We talk with Dr. Marianne Legato. She says there's an astonishing amount of gender discrimination in medicine. That's why she co-founded a center at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons dedicated to helping doctors understand the unique needs of women patients. Also today, spoofing the Beatles. We talk with Neil Innes about the Ruttles, the group he created with Eric Idle of Monty Python to parody the Beatles. Innes is also a founding member of the comedy rock group The Bonzo Dog Band. The Ruttles have reunited to make a new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Marianne Legato, is a specialist in women's health. I don't mean gynecology. She co-founded a center at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons that's dedicated to helping doctors understand the unique needs of women patients in every aspect of their health care, from headaches to heart attacks. Dr. Legato is also an internist with a private practice. She's written extensively on heart disease in women and how it is often misdiagnosed. That was the subject of her first book, The Female Heart. Her new book is a more general examination of women's health issues called What Women Need to Know. I asked Dr. Legato why she thinks it's necessary to have a separate branch of medicine for women.
We don't envision it as a separate branch at all. But traditionally, we have done most or all of our research on men or on male subjects. We have therefore extrapolated the data directly to women without modification and without studying most of our observations directly in women. So we have a male model of normal human biology in many respects, and we certainly have a male model of most diseases, particularly, for example, coronary artery disease, in which virtually all investigation has been done traditionally in men.
And you make a really good point in your earlier book about women and heart disease, which is that if a man gets chest pains, he's like rushed to the hospital and people assume he's having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. If a woman has chest pains, what happens?
Unfortunately, physicians are twice as likely to dismiss women's symptoms as emotional or in their heads as they are identical symptoms of a coronary artery disease in a man.
Now, I have to say, this is anecdotal evidence, but I know a lot more men who have had heart trouble than women, and a lot more older men who have had heart bypass surgery than I know women who've had it. So it just, like, anecdotally, it actually would seem to me that men have more heart problems than women.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that's such a popular misconception. It is true that more men than women have coronary artery disease, which is what we're talking about, until the last decades of life in which women surpass men in the incidence of coronary artery disease. But I think the important fact to emphasize, Terry, is this. 500,000 American women are dying in the United States annually of cardiovascular disease. A little over 260,000 are dying of all cancers combined, and under 50,000 a year are dying of breast cancer. So that sort of, I think, refocuses where women's attention should be. Most women, when they're asked what they most fear, will answer without blinking an eye, breast cancer. They think they're most likely to die of breast cancer, and they don't consider, nor do many of the physicians caring for them, unfortunately, that heart disease is a significant enemy. So that's the illusion that we're trying to correct.
Is heart disease most likely to strike women when they're older, in their 70s or 80s?
In general, heart disease, coronary artery disease, appears a decade later than it does in men. Men begin to exhibit coronary artery disease at about the age of 35 in meaningful numbers. But between 40 and 60, as many women die of heart disease as die of breast cancer. By the age of 60, a woman is as likely to have a heart attack as is a man.
I think a lot of people assume that since women appear to be under so much more stress now because they're holding down jobs plus raising children and taking care of the house, that the kind of pressures that men were under that maybe helped bring on heart attacks, women are under now too.
I happen to love that question.
Okay. Is there any truth to that?
Uh-huh. Let me tell you something. You know, I have had that said to me so often. I'll finish a talk and a man will stand up in the audience and he will say, well, of course you're having more heart disease now than you had before. And of course that's becoming an issue. You're starting to feel the same kinds of stresses that we are. The laughable fact is the following. Women who work and feel rewarded by their work. They enjoy it. They feel rewarded by it, either socially or personally or financially rewarded, and who have no other major responsibilities are at the lowest risk of coronary artery disease, which I think is fascinating. Women whom the Framingham study has characterized as pink-collar workers, that is, women who are in jobs in which they feel invisible or under-rewarded or just sort of tools of the boss for whom they are working, in fact, have an increased risk compared to the average woman for coronary artery disease. Women at the highest risk for coronary artery disease are those who combine unrewarding work with the responsibilities of child rearing. So the interesting truth about work is that it's actually preventive and a good thing to do if, in fact, you're not stressed by conflicting responsibilities and if you feel that the work is exciting and rewarding.
So how is this affecting how doctors treat women for heart problems?
Well, I think that the whole issue of how physicians treat women for heart problems is fascinating. I have just finished a manuscript written in collaboration with Prevention Magazine experts on a survey that looked at women's perception of what was their most important health enemy, and also what advice or preventive medicine they were receiving from their physicians. And one of the scariest things about that survey in 1996, after my book and all the efforts I and many, many others of my colleagues have done to inform women and the physicians who care for them about the dangers of heart disease for women, I was quite personally disappointed to see that a very high percentage of physicians never mention heart disease to their female patients as a health threat or as something against which they should be taking preventive medicine or changing their lifestyles, even to women over 60, which I thought was pretty amazing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Marianne Legato, and she's the author of the new medical book, What Women Need to Know, and she directs the Partnership for Women's Health at Columbia. What are some of the questions that women ask you that they seem most uncomfortable asking their own doctors?
I think the most frequent questions I hear, if I give a woman enough time and enough comfort to ask, are questions about sexuality, self-image, how to reduce stress, how to care better for family members, and right at the end of the list, questions about personal appearance that seem to be things that they're shy about asking.
Well, give me an example of personal appearance questions that you'd ask a doctor.
Well, many women who are reaching the 40 to 50 decade worry about their sexual desirability or their attractiveness, particularly if they've had a divorce or a recent separation. And they often ask my opinion about liposuction and facelifts, not only where to go, but do I think it's important, which is kind of an interesting question and one I welcome.
And do you think it's important? And is it something that you advise, liposuction or plastic surgery?
What I advise is to have the best sense of yourself that it's possible to have. You know, I've always believed that personal attractiveness was much more related to the affection of the beholder than it was to symmetry of features. Think of the person you most admire, and I really don't think that it matters whether that person is sort of authentically beautiful or certifiably beautiful. It's really your response to them that characterizes the relationship. So I'd like to get the focus off personal appearance for women in general and into what they mean to the people around them. However, performers, for example, depend a great deal on personal appearance, and that's kind of a different situation. So I think I try to tailor the answer to the person asking the question.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about one of the more controversial issues in women's health for women who are middle-aged, and that is hormone replacement therapy. Do you have a strong pro or con stand on that?
Well, you know, that's the question that women over 45 or thereabouts who are called perimenopausal, those women looking at the specter as they see it of menopause, and those who are going through menopause most frequently ask me. And yes, I do have a point of view. First of all, I think every woman ought to know what indications there are in her individual case for using hormones, and there might be one of several. And here are some of the things that a woman should rate herself on or think about. Estrogen does not only work on the reproductive system. It has an effect on almost every tissue of the body, and that effect is, for example, very marked in the brain, where it helps the brain maintain what's called plasticity. We develop new neuronal connections in our brain whenever we remember something new or see something new. We need estrogen, we believe, and those of us who have looked at it, to maintain the ability of the brain to function clearly and to remember things. And so in women who describe to me, as one of my very good friends did, I have fuzzy thinking since this menopause, I'd like to recommend a trial for estrogen replacement for impaired memory, particularly for names or things, or walking, the kind of woman who walks into a room and says, "What did I come in here for? Here I am and I can't remember why I'm here." I think that estrogen might be considered for that particular symptom. The second is intolerable symptoms of menopause that are quite traditional, like drenching hot sweats, particularly if they occur at night. Women often describe those of who are disturbed by hot flashes, or hot flushes as they're called, waking up sometimes every 3 or 4 minutes with a sensation of overwhelming warmth and then drenching sweat that follows. That is what I would call one of the intolerable symptoms of menopause, and a woman might very easily find those treated quite adequately by estrogen. Women who are assessed for estrogen replacement should also have their bone density measured, and there's a very good test to do that now. It takes about 45 minutes. I myself just had one. And the actual density or thickness of bones at strategic points, usually your spine, your hip, and your wrist, is measured. If that is low as compared to women of the same age, in my patient, I would recommend a trial of estrogen as one of the possible therapies for osteoporosis, as it's called, or thinning bones. The third and most exciting area, I think, on the horizon is that we now know, through the work of Philip Sorrell and a group of his colleagues in England and in other areas of the world, that estrogen stabilizes the coronary arteries of women, and that some women who are experiencing odd chest pain and palpitations as part of their menopausal symptoms respond to estrogen replacement. So I think, to cut to the conclusion, each woman should be individually assessed for her need for hormonal replacement therapy. You know, 20% of women who have menopausal, who are at menopause, or 20% of women who undergo menopause do not need hormonal replacement therapy. The remaining 80% have to be carefully looked at to see whether, in fact, the benefits to them will outweigh the risks.
What are the risks of hormonal replacement therapy, and which women do you think should avoid it?
Well, the risk most people are concerned about who come to my office for information is the risk of cancer. Now, we know that if we give estrogen alone, that there is a very high likelihood that women will develop cancer of the uterus. This risk for cancer of the uterus with estrogen therapy is almost completely extinguished if the woman is given progesterone along with the estrogen. Some women take progesterone every day. Some women take it only for a part of their cycle. But I do not believe that hormonal replacement therapy, if it's properly given, will cause cancer of the uterus. There is a small increase in the risk for breast cancer in women who use hormonal replacement therapy who are over 60 and who have used it for 5 years or longer, according to the nurse's study.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Marianne Legato, and she directs the Partnership for Women's Health at Columbia. She's also the author of a new medical information book for women called What Women Need to Know. Dr. Legato, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Marianne Legato, author of the new medical book, What Women Need to Know, and director of the Partnership for Women's Health at Columbia. Dr. Legato, I assume you teach at Columbia.
I do. I love it.
Good. Well, I'm wondering how what you teach about women's health compares to what you were taught about women's health.
Was I ever taught about women's health? Women's health in medical school for me in the 60s was, here's what you have to know about women, which entirely had to do with their reproductive systems. Mm-hmm. That's all we studied, was the pelvis. I found out only through treating women and taking care of patients that there was, as I like to say, life above the pelvis, and that women, in fact, had brains that think, hearts that beat. And all of female biology deserves a careful look. There are so many aspects of female biology that are unique and that are different from that of men. I have just written a little book called Gender-Specific Aspects of Human Biology for the Practicing Physician. And it really surveys in a quick way for the practicing physician how different men and women are. And not just in their reproductive systems, but in fact, the anatomy and function of the human brain is different in men and women. The electrical properties of their hearts in some respects are different. The sizes of their hearts is different. The normal function of bowel is different in men and women. And some of the most important characteristics of the skin differs between men and women.
Go ahead.
Finally, the way men and women metabolize drugs can be dramatically different. So I think that as the great Florence Hazeltine, one of my most respected and admired colleagues, has been heard to say, if men had any sense, they'd be studying women. I think that those of us who are involved in this partnership are convinced that there are great gaps in our information about normal human function because we have studied only one gender. And that as we look at the natural experiment and use it in our clinical research of two genders, we will learn a much more complete picture of how human beings function, of how to treat disease more accurately, and indeed of how disease works in a much more accurate fashion.
Maybe you could tell us about some of the differences between the man and the woman medically. What's most intriguing to you right now?
Well, it may sound funny, but one of the most intriguing differences to me is that there are differences in the salivary composition in the substances that are in the saliva of men and women, and that furthermore, the salivary composition of women differs with the phases of her menstrual cycle. To me, that was an amazing revelation, and it struck me that people, for example, making toothpaste might not have taken that into consideration when they made a toothpaste.
So what does that mean functionally if your saliva is different?
We don't know. I think it's just an observation.
Uh-huh.
And one of the important questions comes,
right,
once you know about this difference, What is the next question to ask? Does it, in fact, mean that women have an advantage over men with regard to tooth decay or plaque formation or digestion of their foods? Are there foods that are easier for women to digest than men? Who knows?
So tell me some of the things that you're telling your students now about women's health, things that you wish somebody had told you.
I think that one of the things I hope I'm telling my students is that women are complete human beings, and that's not a facetious remark, that a female patient should be approached with the same thoroughness and the head-to-toe assessment that male patients should. You know, traditionally, when our daughters get to be 18 and go off to college, we send them to the gynecologist, and the gynecologist is responsible for most of their care, or all of it, until the first medical crisis arises that is not about their menstrual cycle or something associated with their reproductive life. Our sons, we kind of leave to the sports docs or the coach until the first medical problem arises. The people who are giving the best comprehensive care to boys, to men and women, or males and females, in fact, are the pediatricians, if you really think about it. When you take your baby for a general checkup, girls get the same kind of general going over that boys do. I think it's not a bad model for adults to be looking for in their medical care. Don't you think that's kind of interesting?
Yeah, I do. Do you think that there's going to come a time when there's one group of doctors that treat men and another group that treat women?
I sure hope not. I am not for ghettoizing women's medicine into a separate specialty. I want to mainstream women into the best medicine available and have them have the same general thorough approach with a profound appreciation of the uniqueness of men and women. I want them to be treated by the best. And I think that women should not be segmented off into a specialty which only a few are entitled to practice. I think they should be part of the general run of, may I say, mankind, and be exposed to the best medicine there is. We need to benefit from our information that women give us as patients and as the objects of our care or the subjects of our care. And I think to make a separate specialty of women's health may have very unfortunate consequences. It will not do at all what I hope we do, which is integrate women into the way we take care of patients so that we can learn from them and apply the lessons that they teach us to the way we treat all patients.
Well, Dr. Marianne Legato, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure to chat. I hope it's been helpful.
Dr. Marianne Legato co-founded the Partnership for Women's Health at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Her new book on women's health is called What Women Need to Know. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm sitting in a dandelion den.
Coming up, not quite the Beatles, they're the Ruddles. We talk with Neil Innes about the band he co-founded to spoof the Beatles. He also co-founded the comedy rock group The Bonzo Dog Band. The Ruddles recently reunited to record a new CD.
never found someone to share my rendezvous.
Do you spend the time like me, wishing that you could be free, free from all you have to do, doing only what you want to?
Oh yes, of course I do. Hang on, who are yous?
We're the other members of the band.
And who invited yous to sing along? Go on, answer that.
Well, no one, we were only passing by.
Well, kindly keep on going if you please.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With so many new Beatles reissues and documentaries, it's good to know The Ruddles are back. The Ruddles is a band that was created in the 70s to spoof the Beatles. They have a new CD called Archaeology. My guest is Neil Innes. He co-founded The Ruddles with Eric Idle of Monty Python fame. Innes wrote and produced the music. Idle wrote and co-directed a spoof documentary film called The Ruddles, which is now out on video. George Harrison, a genuine Beatle and a longtime friend of Innes, appeared in the Ruddles documentary as a TV interviewer. Neil Innes also wrote a lot of music for Monty Python and co-founded the cult music comedy group The Bonzo Dog Band. The Ruddles started after Eric Idle asked Neil Innes to help write a parody of Hard Day's Night for a comedy series called Rutland Weekly TV.
That's all it was, initially. And then there was a whole sequence of excitement and disappointment about the Beatles getting together again and in New York, and I think somebody was offering $3 million or something if the Beatles could get back together again. And on Saturday Night Live, Lorne Michaels came up with the idea to offer $3,000.
Right.
And and he actually got George Harrison to turn up and accept it, only to be told he had to share it with the other three, although he needn't tell Ringo. This sort of banter, you know. And then they got Eric Idle to host the show because he said he could get the Beatles together for $300. And so, in fact, he couldn't, but in fact, what he'd got was the Ruttles, and so they showed the Ruttles instead on Saturday Night Live. And the mailbag response was such that, you know, that Lorne was able to go to NBC and get the money to make the whole story.
Oh, so that's how the whole the Ruddles movie got started.
That's right. And it was because of the chance to make the movie, they turned around to me and said, look, can we have 20 more Ruddles songs by next Thursday lunchtime? And that's how I became a parodist.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
So what did you do? Go back and listen to all the Beatles songs and really study them and deconstruct them?
No, I didn't. I knew if I'd listened to the Beatles songs, it would have just been, you know, I'd been overawed. You know, I just couldn't have got an idea. So I thought back to the various sort of milestones or signposts of their career, and I thought about how I'd heard it, because, I mean, I'm a contemporary. I'd been around, and I thought about what I was doing. And I started writing songs from that perspective. Sort of my own songs. I mean, I knew they'd have to have different tunes and different lyrics, you know. So I had to write my own songs. And then once the songs were written, I sort of listened to Beatles records very hard to listen to the production techniques and things like that. And then we had to put on these silly Rutland accents and talk like that. And that's how, you know, Ruttle Music was born.
Let me play one of the songs that I particularly like. This is Hold My Hand. This is a kind of summary almost of the Beatles' early songs. Lyrically, it has I Want to Hold Your Hand and Please Please Me. And musically, it also has All My Lovin' in it.
No, it doesn't. You're just saying that.
Yes, it does.
Well, I can't hear it.
No?
No.
Really?
It's a different tune and a different lyric.
Oh.
Anyway, well, let the people decide.
My producer says I'm right.
Oh. Well, in that case, I'm leaving. I'm leaving. I'm leaving in a huff. And if that's not quick enough, I'm leaving in a minute and a half. Your producer's miming the same line. We obviously, your producer and I, like the Marx Brothers, we obviously get on.
Well, let's let the listeners be the judge. This is Neil in a song, Hold My Hand, sung by The Ruddles.
I'm not the kind of guy who likes to play Big Brother, but I've just seen your date outside. He's with another. I saw you both come in.
Okay, Neil Innes, who was right?
I don't know. Well, you have to remind me what the original Beatles were. In fact, I just hearing it then, I think the bongos are too loud because we were amazed to hear there's bongos and things going on, and so I think we just put in these various sounds and mixed them up in our own way.
What else did you want to capture from the early sound of the Beatles?
Well, also that it was done on a lot less sophisticated equipment than we were working on. I think it wasn't until Sgt. Pepper that, and then they strung four-track machines or even more together to get all the multi-tracking going. And we were working on 24-track, and it was all rather super-duper. And so we had to actually, squash the sound a bit to make it sound as though it had been recorded on less sophisticated equipment.
No,
we haven't done that this time around. We haven't been quite so anal about the accuracy, whatever.
No, in the Ruddles documentary, All You Need Is Cash, there's a send-up of the film Help, and of course the theme song, you had to write the theme song for the film, which is Ouch. And now you can't tell me that this isn't inspired by the song Help.
The first album had to be signposts, like, of the various things that happened in the Beatles' career. One, of course, was Hard Day's Rut and whatever it was, and Ouch, two films. We had to have a kind of an Ouch song. We also had to have a kind of Magical Mystery Tour song. We had to have a kind of Sgt. Pepper song. Because the job was to tell the story of the Beatles in the silliest possible way.
Really?
And deny all existence of the Beatles. because it was the Ruttles. These were the real, the real thing. And this is what tickled George Harrison most of all, because it really took the pressure off, people wanting the Beatles to get back together again, when it was clear to them and most people that, they obviously weren't ready to at all.
Well, let's hear Ouch. This is the Ruttles. A song written by my guest, Neil Innes.
Ouch, you're breaking my heart. Ouch, I'm falling apart. Ouch, 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 ouch. When we first met, I must admit, I felt for you right from the start. Now when we meet, all kinds of things, it seems upset the apple cart.
In the documentary about the Ruddles, while this is sung, you see the Ruddles as the Beatles doing all these, zany, surreal things.
Zany, low-budget surreal things, yes.
Yeah, that's right. Running around doing zany antics, and sometimes the film speed is sped up and sometimes it's slowed down. What makes the whole thing, so absolutely absurd is that, people were so obsessed with the Beatles that to watch them doing anything zany, it was wow, it's the Beatles. And of course, to watch the Ruddles being sped up or slowed down is so pointless. It's a scream.
Well, I think we were also making quite a few in-jokes about movie-making cliches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things you never should do if you're making a movie is to, you know, sort of what we did. And when the lyric said, upset the apple cart, and there's a shot of an apple cart being upset. So, I mean, we were doing blatant cliches at the same time.
And then the apples fall on each of your heads just in time
absolutely.
For you to say, ouch.
Ouch, I know. Ricky Fattah never could say ouch. If you look at it very closely, he just laughs every time. We wasted so much film on him.
But of course, what you're saying of that being like the perfect movie cliche, you show me the rock video that hasn't done that in the years since.
Well, I know. You see, I challenge this completely pointless thing. You see, us running around like the Beatles was merely a ploy. You know, we're really trying to detract people from noticing the terrible cliches we were doing.
My guest is Neil Innes, co-founder of The Ruddles. They have a new CD called Archaeology. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Innes, co-founder of The Ruddles, a band he created to parody the Beatles. He also wrote music for Monty Python and co-founded the music comedy group The Bonzo Dog Band. I wonder what you were doing when the Beatles first became popular. Were you playing music yet? How old were you?
I'm only a couple of years younger than them. Maybe four, I don't know. But I was at art school, I think, when I first heard them. I was about 16 or 17. And I think it was She Loves You or something like that, come on. And I wasn't, you know, really aware of the Beatles much, and because I was mucking about at art school. I was quite a serious art student.
So you weren't very aware of the Beatles. When did you become very aware of the Beatles?
Oh, well, I think I really started to admire them when Penny Lane came out. I thought that was such a good song. It had sort of lots of images and it had such a interesting construction.
Did you follow them into the psychedelia period? Did you play their records backwards?
No, I mean, I enjoyed them. I mean, because by then I think we got our own band called the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. It started off as the Bonzo Dog Dada Band, but we got rather tired of, you know, trying to explain to tedious, you know, people who wanted to know what Dada meant and to explain what a turn of the century anti-art movement was in a, you know, a few brief sentences proved rather difficult. And so we changed Dada to Doodah. So that's what we were doing. We were art students. We were playing in pubs and whatnot. And in fact, we started looking more like the Beatles looked before they did. And, you know, we were going out with sort of silly moustaches and weird jackets and trousers. And lo and behold, you know, then out comes Strawberry Fields and they've got moustaches and round glasses. We thought they were trying to steal our act, you see.
Well, the Bonzo Dog Band was... I'm glad you told the story about how the name came about. I had no idea that you started out as the Dada Band. But the Bonzos were such a great band, really funny. You did a lot of... all the songs there were absurd or funny or... parodies of a certain style. How did that come about?
Well, we started off, you know, we just enjoyed making this kind of terrible row, really. Nobody was very good on the instruments, but we used to go down to sort of street markets and find old wind-up 78 gramophone records, which you could buy for a few pennies. And this is, you know, normal student fun, you know, the least money on the most fun is what you have to, you know, try and budget for. And we'd take these things back and not know what they were until we got them home and we put them on the wind-up gramophone and there'd be a title, sort of like, I'm going to bring a watermelon to my girl tonight. Well, you see, you sniff that one out. You think, aha, there might be something here. And sometimes there was a giveaway on the label saying Novelty Foxtrot. So you'd take that home and then you find this silly song with a silly tune and a lyric like... I brought my love an apple, she let me hold her hand. I brought my love a banana, we kissed beneath the band. I brought my love an orange, she let me squeeze her tight. I'm going to bring a watermelon to my girl tonight. Ba-da-dum-dum-da. And stuff like, he kissed her. Who did? He did. Where? On her doorstep last night. And we just learnt this stuff and played it in licensed establishments. And it proved to be very good drinking music. And we got, you know, pocket money for doing it. And one of the things was, you know, we had a manager at the time that it was quite, let's say, frugal. You know, if we'd spent 2 hours on a track, you know, he said, right, next one. And we sort of, but we haven't finished, please, sir, you know. He said, well, you can't take longer than 2 hours, 3 hours at the most, you know. And we had this song, The Open Spaceman, that we wanted to do. And Viv Stanshall was down, I think it was in the Speakeasy Club in London, and bumped into Paul, as he often did. And he's moaning about the fact that this bloke, you know, wouldn't let us finish what we were doing. And Paul said, well, I'll come down and produce it. And so he did. So Paul came along and produced Urban Spaceman. And that
was
the
Paul
anyway.
McCartney?
Yeah, sorry, yes, Paul McCartney. Who else? This is the Ruttle Show, isn't it? not any old Paul. I mean, Paul Revere? I mean, never mind. No, yeah, he came down and he produced Urban Spaceman for us. And it was the only way we could get this guy off the control knobs. And it was really funny, actually, because he came in, because we'd all, you know, met all the lads before from the Magical Mystery Tour. But he said, I've just written this, you know. And all of us, we've got to remember, all of us were hyped up to the fact we had to work quickly in the studio and do all this. And he's sort of very relaxed. He sort of waddles over the piano and starts playing, you know. He starts going, hey, Jude. And it hadn't been released. It was the first time, you know, probably anybody outside his close circle had heard it, you know. And I thought, this is not, because he's got a great voice, it's a nice melody, but very slow, and it goes on a bit. Hasn't he got any idea of how much studio time costs, you know? But eventually, you know, we made the record, and it was a very good sporting thing of him to do. And we said immediately, you know, so we can't put your name on it. It'll be a bloody hit immediately, you know. So he said, well, what do you want to put then? We said, well, how about Apollo C. Vermouth as the producer? And he said, yeah, all right. And so it went out as the Bonzo Dog Band. We dropped the doodah because of the change of style. But the Bonzo Dog Band, Urban Spaceman, produced by Apollo C. Vermouth.
And it's your song. You wrote the song.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
and the thing was, it struggled up the hit parade and got to about 17 or thereabouts. And then management couldn't stand it anymore and told everyone, in fact, Apollo C. Vermouth was Paul McCartney. And it shot up to number 5. But that was the only hit the Bonzos had, and we certainly didn't intend to have another one. It was a great, rigorous experience.
Well, why don't we hear I'm the Urban Spaceman?
Okay.
Here it is.
I'm the Urban Spaceman, I'm intelligent and clean.
That's the Bonzo Dog Band, a song written by my guest, Neil Innes, and you're singing lead on it, yes?
Yes, I'm doing the vocal on it, yeah. In fact, that funny noise on the end, sort of a whirring noise, is Viv Stanshall with a garden hose and a trumpet mouthpiece put in one end and a plastic funnel on the other end, and he's whirling it round his head. And in fact, the engineer said, we can't record that, but Paul McCartney said, yes, of course you can, you know, just put a microphone in each corner of the room. It was a very good, fun session, but it took 8 hours.
There's something I need to play from the Bonzos, and this is the intro and the outro, which I think is one of the great absurdist pieces of music ever committed to vinyl.
It's a minor classic, isn't it?
It's wonderful. And this was written by Viv Stanchel, one of the members of the band. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to record this.
Well, you've got to realize that Viv was an extraordinary character. When I first met him, he was slightly overweight and wearing check trousers like Billy Bunter and a Victorian frock coat. He had oval mauve pince-nez glasses, you know, the ones with outside bits just perch on your nose, carrying a euphonium under his arm, and large pink rubber ears, false ears. And I thought, he's an interesting character. And it was his idea to do the intro and the outro, and it's such a silly, simple idea, but when we did it on four-track, we almost gave up because we had to sort of bounce everything down to another one-track and then do more and more. But if you play it, you'll see that it's, you know, these days that people may not believe that it was actually done on four tracks, but it was. But it's a lot of fun. We had a politician called Quentin Hogg who became Lord Chancellor, and we thought it'd be fun to have him on Pig Grunt. But he was very litigious in the 60s, and so we thought we'd write a letter saying, you know, we wanted to include him on Pig Grunt. Did he have any problems? And his secretary wrote back and said, Lord Hogg hasn't had the chance to listen to the record, but perhaps better remove it to be on the safe side. So you hear this rather wild noise every now and again.
Well, let's hear the intro and the outro of the Bonzo Dog Band.
Hi there, nice to be with you. Happy you could stick around. Like to introduce Legs Larry Smith, drums. And Sam Spoon's rhythm pole. And Vern Dudley Bohay Noel, bass guitar. And Neil Innes, piano. Come in, Rodney Slater, alto saxophone. With Roger Ruskin Spear on tenor sax. Hi, Vivian Stanchel, trumpet. Big hello to Big John Wayne, xylophone. And Robert Morley, guitar. Billy Butlin, spoons. And looking very relaxed, Adolf Hitler on vibes. Nice. Princess Anne on sousaphone. Introducing Liberace, clarinet. With Garner Ted Armstrong on vocals.
Did you ever or did you ever want to just play straight pop music? And did you ever or did you ever want to write straight pop songs instead of surreal songs or parodies of other people's songs?
No, not at that time. But, I mean, the Bonzos sort of broke up because we'd stopped arguing. We sort of withdrew into the sort of things we secretly wanted to do ourselves, you know. Yeah, I'd got tempted by writing some songs. One of the songs I wrote during the Bonzo was quite a tender little thing called I Want to Be With You. And I was married and I had a son and I was a very gooey parent and I've always been sort of like a home person. I was not much of a clubby person. So, yeah, I was tending to go that way.
My guest is Neil Innes, co-founder of The Ruddles and the Bonzo Dog Band. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Over there, Eric Clapton, ukulele. Hi, Eric. On my left, Sir Kenneth Park, bass sax. Great honor, sir. Especially flown in for us, a sessions gorilla on Vox Humana. Nice to see incredible shrinking man on euphonium. Drop out with Peter Scott on duck call. Hearing from you later, Casanova, on horn. Yeah, digging General de Gaulle on accordion. Really wild, General. Thank you, sir. Roy Rogers on trigger. Tune in Wild Man of Borneo on bongos. Count Basie Orchestra on triangle. Thank you.
My guest is Neil Innes, one of the founders of the Bonzo Dog Band and one of the founders of The Ruddles, the band that parodied the Beatles. And not only is there a re-release on video of the documentary about the Ruddles, but the Ruddles have a new record, new songs by the Ruddles. The album is called Archaeology, and I think it's time to hear something from the new Ruddles. And I'm going to ask you to choose a song that you'd particularly like to hear from it and to tell us about writing it and what you were thinking of when you wrote it.
Well, why don't we start off with the one that kicks off the album? I mean, the whole point, all this time has gone by since we did the first one. And I think we need to remind people what the Ruddles were. And this is a kind of curtain raiser. And it has a kind of a very obvious, you know, parallel with Sergeant Pepper. And it's called Major Happy's up-and-coming Once Upon a Good Time Band. But it, this album is much more of an autobiographical album about the Ruddles, whereas the first album was more or less a semi-official biography of the Beatles, but in a silly way. So this is Major Happy. And if you say Major Happy, you see Major Happy.
Ah,
it could
right.
be Made You Happy.
Or as in Major, saluting the Major Happy.
Absolutely.
My favorite part of the song is the way there's a count-off after the song has begun.
Yeah. Well, anything goes.
That's right. Okay, this is from the new Ruddles album, Archaeology. What was it like for you to get back in the Ruddles' spirit after having left it for so many years?
Well, good question, because I was a little reluctant, actually. The whole thing about the first one was in 1978, you know, much happier times, and along comes 1980 and the appalling assassination of John Lennon. And, in fact, I remember Eric and I talking very earnestly about maybe filming a special, you know, new ending for the video. But we decided against it in the end because, you know, we'd done it in good faith at that time and that's what it had to be, and the Ruddles were separate anyway, and for heaven's sake, you know, you can't do any good by doing things like that. But, you see, a lot of water's passed under the bridge since then, and what I don't want to do now, you know, because if I can explain, you know, partly why we've done it, is because people suggested that we did it.
Mm-hmm.
When it was pointed out to me, you know, well, the Beatles have got their anthology and they're emptying their cupboards, as it were, you know, surely the Ruddles have got to do something. So I asked the others and I asked George Harrison and he said, of course you should, you know, I mean, it's all part of the soup. Which I think is a nice way of putting it.
Why don't we play one more song from the Ruddles' new album? How about Joe Public? Would you say something about writing it?
Yeah, Joe Public, you know, started off as a song I wrote for a one-man show called Joe Public. I was playing around with the idea of who Joe Public was and whether he had an identity or not. And it just basically sort of plays with that kind of notion. My name is Joe Public. I'm sure you all know me. Sometimes they call me the man in the street, but I don't mind, you know. So it's that kind of thing. And, of course, it was totally different, just playing it with a guitar. But when we put Ruttle clothes on it, it came out like this.
I'm
Neil Innes co-founded the Ruddles, a band that spoofs the Beatles. They reunited for a new CD called Archaeology. Innes also co-stars in the Ruddles documentary, which is out on video, and he co-founded the Bonzo Dog Band. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.